So about 2 years ago, Chris was on his summer holidays, and he asked me to preach, and I came up with a series of preaching through the Ten Commandments. I thought this would be great, and you know, it would just be like 10 sermons that would come together really well. And I haven't been wrong that it's been great. I'm not saying that was not true. It has been a year and a half since I started doing the Ten Commandments, and we're on number 8. So that shows you how often I preach, I guess. But we're on number 8 today, and my goal is to get all 10 done before Chris leaves on sabbatical so that I can start a new series after he leaves. So I will be preaching again at the end of December and the beginning of January to hopefully wrap up the Ten Commandments. So if this is a series you've been just dying to hear more about, don't miss the last Sunday of December and the first Sunday of January, because that's when I'm wrapping it up. We're talking about lying and coveting. But today, we're talking about stealing. I want to quickly go over why this, sort of how this series has been working. We're calling this series Playing by the Rules. And for those of you who aren't aware or don't know me that well yet, I'm a huge nerd. Like, if you can imagine the most nerdy people, I'm probably worse. And my number one thing I love in sort of nerddom, nerd culture, is games. I'm a big games guy, board games specifically. I love board games. Sitting down at a table with a group of friends, laying out the Settlers of Catan board and rocking out a game of Settlers. I would name other games, but you probably wouldn't know them. Unless you play games with me, then you would, because we play those ones. Awesome board games. I love board games. And one of the strengths I have when it comes to board games is rules. I memorize them. I read them. I read a rule book, and I memorize like everything in it. It's sick. It's disgusting. But as I developed this understanding of games and rules, I discovered that there's three ways in which we approach rules. And I'm going to get into that a little bit more in a moment, but there's sort of three ways we approach rules, and that's the rule as it's written, the rule as it's intended, and the rule as it's corrected by the maker of the game. And so when we look at rules in that way, kind of can look at the Ten Commandments in a similar way. So we're going to do that today. The other thing about rules that I discovered when I got really into board games was that rules aren't designed to restrict the players who are playing the game. See, the rules always begin with a goal. A good rule book, the best rule books, is when you open it up and on the first page it says how to win. And it tells you the goal. So 10 points, you know, that's Settlers of Catan, 10 points to the win. Chess, it would say something like defeat the opponent's king or put them in checkmate. Settlers, oh, I already did Settlers. In all sorts of activities, games, and competitions, there's always a goal. I used to run long distance runs when I was in high school. And so the goal was always get to that finish line, right? But there was these rules. The rules outline how you get to that goal. And so in a race, for example, you had to stay in your lane. If you were left your lane, you were disqualified from the race. You lost. So rules weren't about restricting my ability to run the race, but rather outlining the boundaries in which I was to run it. And to reach the goal the correct way, I had to stay within those boundaries. Board games are the same way. Settlers of Catan gives you a bunch of rules on how to play the game, on how to do trading with players, how to buy the settlements, how to do this stuff. They're not restricting you from playing the game. They're outlining the means by which you achieve the goal of getting 10 points. In the same way, our 10 commandments are not restrictive of our life, but rather give us the guidelines on how to live in order to reach the goal. And the goal, of course, is to be in relationship with Christ and live eternity in heaven, glorifying God and living in the light that is God's glory. So if our goal is to live an eternity in relationship with Christ, then the rules give us an outline by which we reach that goal. The race, Paul frequently refers to the Christian life as a race or a marathon, and run the race laid out before you. To run the race, we have to know where the lines are. We have to know where the finish line is. We have to know what the rules of the race are. Otherwise, I told this story a couple months ago, last time I preached on this, but otherwise we end up like my children, Olivia and Lucy. They're little five-year-olds. They run around our front yard and they play these games, and they're racing around the yard, and all of a sudden Olivia will just say, "I win!" Some of you are like, "Yes, Andrew, you told the story." Yes, I did. It's a good example. She just yells, "I win," and Lucy drops to the ground. "I didn't win." And I go, "Well, how do you know?" "Well, she said she won first, I guess." But they didn't have a finish line. They didn't have a racetrack. They didn't even start at the same place or even have the same goals in mind. They had no boundaries that outlined their race. And so we need these boundaries that outline and guide our life. And that's what the Ten Commandments kind of are, and or are part of. And so that's this Ten Commandments series. We're looking through sort of what is the outline by which we run the race laid out before us. So today we're talking about stealing. And stealing is a significant problem in our culture. Make sure this is on. Is it selected? Oh, there we go. Look at that. Okay, cool. So theft, really big issue in Alberta. If you look in your sermon notes, there's more of these numbers. So in Alberta in 2016, we had over 3,038 robberies, 22,800 vehicle thefts, and 93,101 non-vehicle thefts. These are directly from Stats Canada, so these numbers are fairly accurate for 2016. Now these are just, actually that's not even fair. I say they're fairly accurate. These are the numbers of reported or caught thefts and robberies, because these are from Stats Canada. This is not counting ones that nobody knows about or that people got away with. Okay? Shoplifting is one of our number one forms of theft. It is estimated that in North America, more than $10 billion is shoplifted annually in North America. $10 billion. This is a huge issue that is not foreign to us. In fact, my landlord got some new farm equipment, and what he said to me was, make sure people don't see it. Keep it in the garage. Don't leave it laying like out where people can see the new tractor and whatever else, because they tend to go missing in this area. He said, sorry, not just him, but just recently we had our church broken into just last spring. Excuse me. Just getting over a cold a little bit. Just this last spring we had the church broken into, and they took mostly just pop and chips and Pokemon cards. But we were broken into. Just 2 weeks ago, while running some programs here at the church, I sell chocolate bars and pop. I buy it, costs me, 60 cents a thing. I sell them for a dollar a thing, and then the money goes towards our youth program. And I sold all of the chocolate bars I had in my box. I sold all the pop I had in the fridge, and there was only $40. And I assure you, I spent more than $100 on pop and chocolate bars. So I did not even have enough to restock. And that was a program here at the church with people from our church. So theft is an issue that is not foreign to us right here in our church and in our community. It is something that many of us deal with. Many of us have been stolen from and been victims of. And many of us, I think, walk the line of thievery ourselves. So this morning we're going to look at the three ways of looking at this rule. We're going to first look at the rule as it's written. We're going to define what is robbery or theft. What does this mean? What is it? And what kind of things are constituted by it? Secondly, we're going to look... Oops, I'm getting ahead of myself. Secondly, we're going to look at the rule as it's intended. How far-reaching is this? Did God simply mean don't take property? Or is there more to it? Is there a longer reaching and depth of this rule beyond the obvious stealing? That's where we're going to spend most of our time this morning, is probably on the rule as it's intended. And then the errata, I keep pushing the button, I shouldn't. The errata, we're going to look at sort of a case study of how we are to respond to stealing, or if we have ourselves committed the act, how we are to respond, make restitution or repayment. So that's where we're going this morning. So let's begin at the rule as it's written. So the rule, you can find it in the book of Exodus, chapter 20, verse 15, I believe. And for some reason, I'm in Malachi. Ooh. There we go. Chapter 20, verse 15. And it's a very long and extensive rule. It says this: you shall not steal. Make sense? Sermon over. No, I'm kidding. You shall not steal. Now, in our culture, we are like, absolutely, theft is wrong. But there's a couple questions we have to ask ourselves. What if I'm really poor and that person is really rich? Then it's not so bad. They have hundreds of dollars. They're not going to miss 20. They have 3,000 Pokemon cards. They're not going to miss this one, Pikachu. The church has loads of money. They don't need this pop or these snacks. Or the church has lots of money. They won't miss this computer. Okay. Our culture has changed or redefined theft to be based on circumstance. We operate under something called relative truth. I don't think we do. We shouldn't as Christians. We operate under something called objective truth or absolute truth. What is true is always true. But our culture currently in North America operates out of relative truth. That is, what's true for me may not be true for you. So if you're rich, it might be wrong for you to steal, but if I'm poor and need it more than you do, then I can steal. In the movie Guardians of the Galaxy, I love it, right at the very end of the movie, they're leaving and they've become the heroes. This band of like five bandits of sorts have become the heroes of the story, and they're leaving and they say, you know, keep yourselves out of trouble. Don't go breaking the law, because they broke the law earlier in the movie. And Rocket Raccoon, one of the characters, says, well, what if I take something that doesn't belong to me? And they say, that's called stealing, and it's wrong. He goes, no, you don't understand. I want it more than that person. And everyone laughs. But this is actually the mindset of our society. We've made a hero out of characters like Robin Hood, who steals from the rich and gives to the poor, and we see this as a valiant, noble deed. We make him a hero. A couple years ago, very popularized amongst teens was The Hunger Games, and they made some movies and there's books. And it actually, there was an author who attempted to characterize the entire generation coming up as Generation K for Katniss from the book series, The Hunger Games. And this idea is that Katniss is a member of District 12, who is the poorest of the districts of the country, who have almost nothing, and so she goes over the boundaries of the property and hunts illegally and gets food. They also take part in a black market called the Hob, where not only are they allowed to do all kinds of shady, illegal business, but even the guards, many of them are part of it. And there's actually a heart-wrenching moment in the books when a guard who is named as a guard who is okay with everybody operating in the black market and taking part in that shady business dealings, who, when he dies, sorry, spoiler alert, he dies, there's a moment of sadness in the book, and the characters are sad, and the reader who is reading the book is sort of, it strikes you. This is a sad moment when the black market is destroyed and the person who was supposed to be authoritative, who allowed it, also was. We operate in a culture that says, if I'm a victim, then I have the right to what I want because I deserve it for some reason. I'm a victim, though. And this is victim-based mentality that if I don't have, then I can take. But if you have, you can't take because you're not the victim. So this law is very clear. You shall not steal. Regardless of circumstance, stealing is stealing. Theft is theft. There is no gray area in this rule. The rule as it is written is clear and it is firm. And as we go through the rest of the law and throughout the rest of Exodus and Leviticus and a bit in Numbers, we find that there is rules and law and provision for owning property. People are allowed to possess private property. You are allowed to work and make wages. A worker is worthy of his wages, it says in the New Testament. A person is allowed to own cattle and sheep, and they are allowed to own them. They are theirs. And to take from them is to remove the right for that person to have their personal possession. And that is biblical. We also see in the Bible that all things that we are given to us by God. So this law expands a little bit beyond just stealing from a person, but when we steal from a person, we are stealing that which God gave that person, and so we are indirectly stealing from God, and it is God who is offended. So theft does not only hurt the person whom we're stealing from, but it also hurts God who provided for that person. God does not provide for us through theft. That is not a means by which God provides. And so this law of stealing, as it's written, is very clear. Stealing is stealing. And it's not just from a person, it's from God. So now that we're very clear on what stealing is, let's talk about the far reach of stealing. Now some of us might go, okay, so if I steal someone's possession, that's stealing. That's an obvious thing. I stole a chocolate bar, stole a sheep, stole some cows. Well, that's biblical, chocolate bars today. Well, we had a couple cows go missing from our field, so maybe that still happens. I was looking for like rustlers or something, like rolling up in like a covered wagon. Okay. I'm learning the whole farming thing right now. It's very exciting. So don't mind me as I try to make farming references and don't have a clue what I'm talking about. I know that now. It's a M108. Yeah, see? You got to know your tractor number, I was told. So I went and looked it up. Okay, so I was told that's what real farmers know. Although I've also found out that most of the farmers here like just know a ton of tractor numbers. And I'm like, well, I know the one that I drive because I looked it up. Okay, that was totally off topic. Thanks. So stealing, obviously stealing property would be wrong, but it goes beyond just stealing property. The Bible actually goes into a lot of detail in a various number of places about different types of stealing. For example, tax fraud. Ooh, those are in a weird order because it's missing one. Isn't it? No? Okay, cool. Then it just jumped past one, so I'm missing one there. Tax fraud. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, is what Jesus says when asked about taxes. Paying taxes is part of life in our country. We are expected to pay our taxes. Our money does not really belong to us. It belongs to our government. And the money which we are given belongs really to God who gave it to us and is given to us through our government. And when we are required to pay taxes, we should pay them back in full and correctly. Those of us who use loopholes, who misrepresent, or in some way try to withhold expenses or income or our taxes from our government are committing tax fraud and we are committing thievery. We are stealing from our government. It is a huge issue in our world, tax fraud, and the numbers for it are so inconclusive because we don't know how many people actually practice tax fraud. It's impossible to really find out, or they wouldn't be successfully practicing tax fraud because they'd be criminals. Okay, so if you are dealing with that, okay, biblical outline, it's clearly taxes, not paying them, that's stealing. And see, now I'm off by one. I got to stop clicking. Okay. Secondly, paying debt. Taking debt is unrecommended. In the Bible, it recommends that we do not take debt, that we should not be in debt. However, people do get in debt, and they got into debt in the Bible. We get into debt today, especially if you go to school. Let me tell you, I have much debt, although not much longer, like 2 more years maybe, and then I should be debt-free because we're dumping a ton of our income there. But taking debt is not necessarily wrong, but not paying it back in a timely manner is. The Bible is clear in a number of areas that when you are able to pay your debts and choose not to, you are stealing from your debtor. You're the debtor. You're stealing from your master, whoever loaned you the money. You're owned by that person, biblically. In 2 Kings 4, that's the verse reference I put up there, there is a story of Elisha, and he goes to this house of this woman, and she's poor. She only has a little bit of oil in a jar. He says, go gather a whole ton of jars. So she does. She gets a bunch of jars. I kind of picture it as like a bunch of little like mason jars everywhere. It was probably more like big clay jars, but that's cool. He says, okay, go ahead and pour the oil into the jars. So she starts pouring, and she fills a jar, and then she goes to the next jar, and she fills that jar. And by the time she's done, she's filled a bunch of jars full of oil. And Elisha doesn't say, great, now you've got oil. You're good to go. You can sell some of it, have some cash, whatever else. He says, go sell it and pay back your debts. It's the first thing you do. Elisha has just, through miracle of God's work and through the prophet, they have established for this woman an opportunity to gain a bit of wealth in a position where she had none. And it wasn't, okay, great, now you've got some extra spending money. Why don't you go spend that? It was, go pay your debts. First be out of debt. Then we move forward from there. David Ramsey's a big push on that. He's a Christian financial advisor. He has a talk show on the Christian AM channel in the afternoons most days. And his thing is get out of debt. right away as fast as you can. In fact, he says, cut all other non-necessary expenses and pay your debts immediately. Sorry, I just have this sore throat still, just lingering from like weeks ago. Okay. That's just awkward for all of you. I apologize. Okay. So, pay your debts when you can. Not paying your debts when you're able to is theft. Next one, cheating the weights. Amos 8, chapters 4 and 5 talks about businessmen and people in the temple who altered the weights and the loads. You know, we can even look it up real quick because, hey, why not? We're at church. That's what we do. Let's open our Bibles. Amos chapter 8 is an option. It's in the Minor Prophets. They are not alphabetical, so don't try finding it that way. Joel, Amos, Obadiah. So Amos is before Obadiah, comes after Joel. Chapter 8. I didn't bookmark it. I bookmarked other verses. Chapter 8, verse 4 and 5, it says this. Hear this, you who trample the needy and do away with the poor of the land, saying, when all the new moon be over, that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath be ended, that we may market wheat, skimping the measures, boosting the price, and cheating with dishonest scales. These were businessmen, business people, working to increase their profits and decrease value of the product. We see that all over the place in our world. If you are a business person, if you increase profits and decrease value of an item, or worse, somebody brings a product, such as a distributor or some other manufacturer, they bring you a product and you talk them down to lower pricing, their product is not worth as much, and then charge through the roof, you are committing theft, both against the person who provided the product and against the customer who is trying to purchase it, and you are making it difficult for them. You, what's the word here in verse 14? You who trample the needy and do away with the poor. It is our responsibility as business people to work in honest business, to be above board, and to not seek personal wealth in such a way that it harms others. That is theft, according to this law. A payment of bad wages is found in James chapter 5. A worker is worthy of his wages, paying poorly or paying a bad wage or paying a check that's going to bounce. This would be a form of theft. A person who has worked has earned their payment. By refusing to pay them, you steal from them their work's value. That one is not going to go. There we go. And finally, moral purity is another significant theft. We find this very clearly in the story of David and Bathsheba. David is steals her moral purity. Absolutely, there's two people at work here that takes two to tango, as it were. But that said, there's still a theft of moral purity. A person can steal moral purity. Young men and young women, I talk to youth a lot about things like their relationships, and in February we'll be doing a series specifically on dating. And men and women, boys and girls, you only have your moral purity so long as you currently have it. You give it up once, it's gone. You steal the moral purity from young women, men, when you engage in behaviors not appropriate to your standing. If you're not yet married, those behaviors are inappropriate. And you steal their moral purity. The same way, girls or young women, you also steal the moral purity from men when you do the same. It is stealing their moral purity. It's removing from them something you can never receive again. It is gone. It is the one thing that you have to give that has of greater value than just about anything else you have personally. Do not give that up freely. Do not give that up easily. Protect your moral purity and do not steal the purity of others. Furthermore, we steal a form of moral purity, but we also steal from our families when we work long hours, neglect them and their time. We do not give them their attention that they need. When we fail to be parents to our children or spouses to our husbands and wives, we steal from our spouse when we lust after other people or fantasize about a relationship that is not the one we are in. We steal from our spouse and from our family. This law encompasses all of that. It is not simply the stealing of property. You shall not steal from another person, their moral purity, from your family, your time, your attention, your parenting, your love. And finally, in Malachi chapter 3, oh, look, there it goes. That's in a weird order. There's the paying taxes. Well, Matthew 22, 21, if you wanted to know, paying taxes. All right. And finally, Malachi chapter 3 talks about robbing God specifically. It says this, I actually preached on this, my third sermon I ever did here at Brightview Church was this one, and it was terrible. Don't look it up. This is a much better version. Okay. In Malachi chapter 3, verse 8, the prophet Malachi speaks a series of questions throughout all of Malachi. He speaks a series of questions that are from God to the people, and then the people give these responses. And so in Malachi chapter 3, verse 8, we see the question, will a man rob God? Yet you rob me. That's God asking the question through Malachi. Will you rob God, but you rob me? And the people ask, how do we rob you? I'm not going to go too far into what the next part says, but it basically says in tithes and offerings. But I'd actually push beyond that. There's actually three ways in which we rob God. So there's three ways. The first is we steal his time. I talked about months ago when I did the sermon on murder, the sixth commandment. When I talked about murder, I talked about how God controls how long we live. He determines our end. And so every minute that we have on this earth is not ours, but his. He has determined for us our time. So in the same way, when we do not give him that time that he has given to us, when we do not respond in kind with the time that he has given us, we steal it from him. Many of us attend a Sunday morning service, and we tick the box, I have given God my Sunday mornings, and then we go about the rest of our day or the rest of our week without another thought about him or towards him. We make our decisions day by day without ever considering the impact it might have on our relationship with him. We have failed to give God the time, and we steal it from him and use it to our own end, use it for sinful end, use it for our own selfish gains and purposes, and we steal from God. Secondly, we steal his authority when we go about our life with anything other than God on the throne of our lives and the throne of our hearts. We steal from him in this way. That is his seat. Our lives are his. Our identity is in Christ. He is the king. And this past Friday, youth night, I'm going through the whole Bible narrative, and we were talking about the kings and how the people wanted a king to rule over them like all the other nations, and yet God had established himself as the king. They were a theocracy, a God-led country, and yet the people wanted a human king to sit on the throne that belonged only to God. They stole his place. In fact, God says to Samuel, they do not reject you, Samuel, they are rejecting me. And so when we fail to make God the authority in our life, to make him our king, when we cease to be theocratic, God as king, we steal his authority and we place something else on the throne. And so we must be careful on whether we are stealing God's authority. And finally, we steal the tithe. And that is specifically what Malachi 8, chapter 3, verse 8 says. And talks about stealing the tithe. And just as God gives us our time, and as God gives us authority and gives us the freedom to operate under his authority, he also gives us our money and our prosperity. And in Canada, we have much prosperity. Some days it's hard to see. I understand that. I lived for a long time on only $500 a month, supporting both my wife and I. And I understand that it's not always easy to see that prosperity. And yet on that $500 a month, we were able to eat. We had a vehicle. We had a house to live in. Well, a basement suite, but you know, it's legit. And I had a job. And I was working on my education. So even in a place where we make very little, we are still more prosperous than much of the world. I had the pleasure of this past summer going into Mexico and helping build houses there. And these people, we found out, they work incredible hours, like just sickening hours. Like think harvest, but all 12 months of the year, okay? They are working endless amounts of hours, 12 hours a day, 6-7 days a week, in order to make barely enough money to buy the property with nothing on it. No utilities. So there's no electricity, there's no plumbing. There's no building. They just buy a patch of dirt. Once they bought the patch of dirt, the taxes on that patch of dirt is basically their entire income, and they can never afford to build on it. And so we got to go and build those houses for them. They experience a poverty like we never do in Canada. I shouldn't say that. Like many of us do not experience Canada. There are those, I did spend time on the downtown east side in Vancouver, and there are those who live in those impoverished situations even in Canada. And yet here, for the most part, those of you who are able to drive yourself to this church this morning are not in those situations. And so when God calls us to tithe, it is not him taking from us. There's this whole meme right now on the internet that taxation is theft. And I think a lot of us in the Christian circles also look at tithe as theft. In fact, I think I saw a remake of that meme on one of my Christian Facebook pages recently that said tithe is theft. And I think we sometimes look at that the church is just taking more money, that the church is somehow wealthy. If you're ever wondering about how our church is doing financially, you can ask our treasurer. Our money and our finances are public. We're a nonprofit organization. Fortunately, Chris and I get paid. That comes back to workers worthy of their wages, I think. But our tithe is not theft. In fact, when we withhold our tithe, it is theft. In no way do I want to guilt you or make you feel like you have to give more. And if you do not tithe, this is not a guilt trip. But it is theft. That's the Bible. I'm just preaching the word, man. Malachi chapter 3, verse 8, if you don't believe me. All right. So let's move on to the errata. And for the errata, I want to look at a bit of a case study in the character of Zacchaeus. You can find the story in Luke chapter 19. And it's the story of Zacchaeus. And some of us may know the Sunday school song. Zacchaeus was a wee little man. Wee little man was he? Okay. We're not really sure how wee little of a man Zacchaeus was. What we do know is that he's a tax collector. And you think taxes are bad today, and we don't like taxes today. Oh man, back then Zacchaeus was so hated just because he was a tax collector. Rome set it up. They needed tax collected. So they don't send their own tax collectors in. Rather, they go to those people groups and they say, we need a tax collector from amongst your own people. So Zacchaeus says, well, I'll work for the government. Why not, right? That's Rome. I'll work for the government. I'll be a tax collector. So Zacchaeus is a Jewish man working for Rome to collect Jewish taxes. The Jews hate him. On top of that, the way that tax collectors collected taxes, they were told how much they were to pay to Rome based on their, you know, region. And then they were told to go out and just make sure that they collected enough to pay that amount to Rome. So they would go to the people and they would know, okay, well, I need $20 from every person. So they'd go up to somebody and they'd say, all right, your taxes are $50. And they pocket the extra 30 for themselves. This was common practice amongst tax collectors. It was known practice, yet to refuse them or resist them was to resist Rome itself and resulted in death. So people paid the tax, even the extremely high taxes that tax collectors may ask for. So Zacchaeus was hated, absolutely hated. I might point out that Matthew was also a tax collector and was one of Jesus' disciples. Very interesting, I thought. Anyways, Zacchaeus, tax collector, hated. He hears about this Jesus guy and that he's in town. He wants to meet him. He's heard that Jesus transforms lives, and maybe Zacchaeus was just getting sick of being hated by everybody. He's kind of alone and doesn't have a whole lot of friends because the friends he does have, he knows he's paying them. He knows the only friends he has are hanging out with him because he's got a ton of extra money, and maybe he gives them a little bit of that tax break. You know what I'm saying? They only actually have to pay the 20, maybe 25, because I got to make a little something, something somewhere. Zacchaeus is feeling that there's something missing in his life, and so he decides to seek Jesus. So he goes to find him, and there's a crowd all around, and when he tries to push the crowd and ask them to get out of his way, nobody moves for Zacchaeus. They hate Zacchaeus. Why would they make room for him to go see the Lord of Lords, the King of Kings, the Messiah who has come to save all of Israel? Why would they make room for this traitor of the people who has stolen our money and paid it to Rome? So he finds a tree and he climbs up in it, and I actually really like this picture that I found because it actually shows other people climbing trees as well. I like that because it was probably the case that this wasn't a unique thing. If crowds gathered around and it was hard to get there, I'm sure many young children or people would climb trees to get at least a view of what was being said. I can imagine the crowds were not just around him on the ground, but that they were up in the houses and in the trees and on the hills, wherever they could get to hear and see what Jesus had to speak. So I'd like to point out that I think we sometimes misunderstand the story. Zacchaeus was probably not the only guy sitting in a tree, kind of awkwardly, okay? There was probably several people up in the trees watching and listening. And so Jesus comes along and he singles this guy out, which I love that, because then when we really understand it in the context of the time, with the crowds of people all around, high above and below and all around Jesus, and he singles out Zacchaeus. He wasn't singling out the one dude sitting on a branch in a tree and like, hey, you're kind of weird, we're going to hang out today. He was singling out Zacchaeus because it was Zacchaeus. Because Jesus knew that Zacchaeus needed to have lunch with him that day. More than any other person in that crowd, Jesus knew Zacchaeus was the one who needed to have lunch with him. So he says, hey, Zacchaeus, come on down. We're going to go for lunch at your place, since you seem to have all the food in this area anyways. So Jesus goes for lunch with Zacchaeus. And sometime during that lunch meeting, during that conversation, doesn't tell us what exactly was said, but something changes for Zacchaeus. In verse 8 of chapter 19 of Luke, Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. Something happened to a man who was willing to cheat his own people in order to receive more. He transformed and paid back half his wealth immediately to the poor, and four times anything he ever stole from a person back to them. This is how we are to deal with theft. I think this morning I have less talked about how to deal with it if you've been stolen from, and more to deal with, are we thieves? And if we are thieves, here's how we are to respond to our own thievery. Firstly, we need to understand that integrity matters to God. It is not okay to be thieves. It is not okay to steal in any of the forms in which I have talked about already. And for all I know, there may be more. This is probably not exhaustive, but it's my best that I could come up with. Oh, see, I did miss one actually in my own notes. We steal people's reputations through slander and rumor. And I was going to be really scathing about how we come to church all together as a community, and then we walk out into the foyer and we spread rumor about other people that sit across the pew from us. It's going to be really scathing and powerful. Feel scathed. sorry. That's why I don't let the youth pastor preach. He makes jokes of stealing. Something about Zacchaeus changed. And he changed from being dishonest, from being lacking in character, from being someone who could not be trusted by his own people, to wanting a life of integrity. And integrity matters to God. We must be a people of integrity. If anyone in our community is to know Brightview Church's people by anything, it should be integrity. We should be people of character. And when we walk through this community and we say, I go to Brightview Church, someone should go, wow, we love the people from Brightview Church. You guys have so much integrity. You guys, the character of the people from Brightview, every time we meet them, they're just so honest and giving, and they never withhold. And what incredible people. Less impacting here, maybe, but there's a story that often gets told in churches. It's a common one, so I'm just stealing it. Although I was told preachers just repeat what's already been said. So that's cool. I'm just stealing the story. It's a very common story, but of Christians, you know, they all gather in a church, and they go to this wonderful church service, and then they walk out the church, go to the nearest Starbucks, and they're the most picky, most rude, and lowest tipping people in a restaurant or in a Starbucks. That may not be as relevant to us, since, you know, the nearest Starbucks is like a 20-minute drive. But the point is that we have a reputation as a whole as Christians of lacking integrity, of lacking character, of lacking in generosity. Let that not be the case for Brightview. We need to establish ourselves with integrity. Integrity matters to God because people will know us by it. Secondly, restitution must be made. If you are a thief, and the more I go through the Ten Commandments, I realize I'm probably all of them, guilty of all of them for sure. And here I am going, if you are a thief, if we are thieves, we must make restitution. This is clearly outlined in the Bible in a number of areas. Of course, in Exodus 22 is very important to look at. Exodus 22, two chapters after the Ten Commandments are given, one of the very first laws to be more clearly defined is the eighth commandment. Exodus 20 gives us the commandments. Exodus 22 starts clarifying them, and the very first one is stealing. Actually, that's not true. Exodus 21 clarifies what it means to treat God correctly, what it means to not worship idols. The first of the five laws, because the laws are broken into two parts, the laws that are about God, laws that are about us. The first one that's dealt with is robbery. And in Exodus chapter 22, it talks about making restitution. If you steal a lamb, you are to return four in restitution. If you steal a cow, you are to return five in restitution. You must make restitution with the person from whom you stole from, or there is punishment to be carried out. We also see the importance of restitution in Luke chapter 19 with the story of Zacchaeus and the restitution he makes. We don't know if Jesus tells him to make restitution, but we know in some part of that conversation, Zacchaeus' heart is transformed from being a thief to being generous and seeking restitution, seeking to restore his reputation and his integrity with the people. And not out of a selfish desire to see himself elevated again, but rather because he had just met the person of Jesus. And it's meeting the person of Jesus when we get transformed. The heart is transformed when Jesus sits down with us and he meets us and we experience him in relationship. That's how it works for Zacchaeus. That's how it works for us today. We are convicted by Jesus and by the relationship we have with him and by the character by which he lived. Jesus was a man of integrity. We need to be the same. After Zacchaeus goes declares that he's going to make restitution, Jesus says this, "Today salvation has come to this house because this man too is a son of Abraham. And for the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost." Zacchaeus was lost. Jesus says, salvation has come to this man and to this whole house because that's why I came, to seek and save the lost. He's here to find us, those who are lost. So I encourage you, if the person of Jesus has not transformed your heart or convicted you, then my challenge for you this morning is to seek a relationship with the person of Jesus. Seek him out. Find that relationship. If you're not sure what that looks like or whether you've experienced that or if you'd like to experience that and you haven't before, you're welcome to come and talk to myself or one of our elders, Ken or Dave. You can also talk to Pastor Chris when he's not on holiday. Every morning after service is done, there's always a team that comes up here to pray with anyone who would like to pray. If you haven't met Jesus, there's an opportunity there to come and pray with them. We are transformed when we meet the person of Jesus. We need to meet the person of Jesus and be transformed. Maybe this morning is the first chance you have to do that. Let salvation come to your house this morning. Meet the person of Jesus and give up a life of theft, thievery, roguishness. So that's the eighth commandment. Do not steal. We went over three things. We went over what does it mean to steal, the wording as it's written. There is no gray area in theft. Secondly, we talked about the depth and breadth of thievery. It goes beyond just stealing possessions. It can go to things like stealing moral purity, to stealing taxes, to stealing time, to stealing reputation through rumors and slander. And finally, we looked at what to do in response. The errata. What does Jesus, what does God desire for us to do in place of thievery? And that is to make restitution and to live with integrity and to be people of integrity. Let us as a church be known as people of integrity. Let's close in prayer as the music team comes up. Lord Jesus, meet with us this morning. Meet with each of us. God, if we have not experienced relationship with you, reveal yourself to us. Lord, we pray that you would help us to see that your life of integrity was not unique to only you, but that it was actually an outline, a blueprint in the way in which we are to also live, that it calls us to be people of integrity. And so, Lord, I pray that you would work in our lives to become people of integrity, to live that out every day. Lord, that as we leave this church, that we would not leave it here, that we would not steal from you our time and our thoughts and the throne of our hearts, but that we would give that to you each day this week, that we would let you rule us, and that we would give you our time, that we would give you our days, and that these would be yours. And Lord, help us to live in such a way that as people hear of Brightview Church, they go, wow, those guys have such character, such integrity, such honesty. That is a church that is different because Christ is there. So Lord, just thank you for being here. For us in your name, amen.